You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
He has seen the future, and it's not so bad, actually. There's less want, there's more civility, and that is according to John Zogby, who's been conducting political and consumer polls for more than 20 years. He explains it all in a new book called The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream, published by Random House. And welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure.
So can you put it into 50 words or less, why the world is getting to be a better place?
I'm going to try. We've learned to live within limits. We've had to. There are huge global changes that are taking place. And, you know, unlike any other time in history, those global changes don't take place over hundreds or thousands of years. They take place at lightning speed. And the American people have learned to cope and to adjust. And, in fact, in many ways, are ahead of their leadership in terms of understanding this.
And so through your polling, you've tried to take the pulse of America over the years. We know you as a political pollster, but of course, that's not how you spend most of your time. In fact, you do a lot for consumer polling and marketers, and they're not unrelated.
No, not at all. Consumers vote every day. And frankly, in terms of politics, it's only about 8 to 10% of what we do, although it is an awful lot of fun, and especially in a year like this. And I have a feeling we're probably going to talk about that a little bit too, but this election. But no, in reality, the two are very related. Same kinds of choices that have to be made, and whatever the political culture is, it also intersects to a great degree with our consumer culture.
But it's even more specific than that. Where you shop tells you where you're going to vote.
Isn't that fun? Yeah, it is. Yeah, we started looking at that a few years ago, and the obvious point was about Walmart. You know, our Walmart customers different, and in fact they are. We did a lot of work in that respect, which made me then wonder, well, what about Costco shoppers and Target and Marshalls and so on? And so we polled immediately after the 2004 election and created a political spectrum from Walmart and Sears and JCPenney all the way to the right to Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus and Filene's all the way over to the left, and Target and Marshall's, those were the stores in the center.
The mainstream. So I'm trying to figure out if that jives with my intuition about shopping, and I think it pretty much does. How did you find this out?
We asked, basically, if you had just simply one store to choose from, figured that was a good way to get to this, which of the following stores would that be? And so they told us what store that would be. And then we did a couple of questions to double check on that. How often do they shop at that store? Do they have a relationship with it? But then from there, what we did was we cross-tabulated that against demographics and against political behavior, notably how you identify yourself on the ideological spectrum by political party, and then who did you vote for?
And you're finding that right, left, and center are still meaningful terms?
Yeah, to a great degree, because what we want to know is how people identify themselves on most issues. But you do hit a nerve in the sense that while it's the ideological conservatives and the ideological liberals that make the news every day, yeah, to a great degree, there's that one-third of the voters in the center who kind of float, not necessarily ad hoc, issue to issue, but they do float. You know, there are social conservatives and fiscal liberals, and there are fiscal conservatives, social liberals, and then there are situational types of people as well.
You have some interesting ways of breaking up the world that we'll talk about later on. Before we get to that, we want to talk about how you divide the generations. And, for example, you talk about the first globals. This is the youngest generation, post-generation X.
Yes.
After the slackers come the first globals. Do you want to go through the whole listing of how you see the world?
Okay. Yeah, let's do that. Let's start with the first globals because in many ways they're the most intriguing. Those are 20-somethings, 18 to 29 years old. We add an additional element to them, those with passports. Most of those with passports have traveled overseas. Since I wrote this book incidentally, where we cite that 42% have an active passport, it's now well over 50% who do.
People also talk about the millennials. Are we talking about the same people?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much the millennials. Why I call them first globals is because they have a planetary perspective, which is really fascinating. But then again, why wouldn't they? In addition to access to travel, having traveled, travel is very much on their radar screen. But they're also exposed through the internet and social networks to friends and colleagues all over the world, to global fashion, to global music. And it is all of this is revealed in their perspective on life. They're 10 points more likely to say, I'm a citizen of the planet Earth, more than a citizen of the United States, much more than any other age cohort.
Right.
One in four tell us they expect, not hope or are optimistic, that they expect to live in some exotic foreign capital. And then in terms of their positions on issues.
That's where the surprises come, right? Because they're not as predictable as you would think?
No. On one hand, we're talking about what we might call liberal, you know, multilateral foreign policy, certainly very multicultural, diverse, appreciative of differences among people. By the same token, take an issue like abortion, which my generation, I'm a boomer, and the Generation X generation just made a mess out of, you know, pendulum swing all the way over here, pendulum swing all the way to the other side. This group is situational, which is very intriguing. Give me the situation, they tell us, and then we'll tell you whether the abortion is legitimate or not.
So they will say that it's morally wrong, but they will also say there are times when it's okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they are, was that John Keats or Fitzgerald? Which one said that, you know, the fine mind can hold two opposing ideas at the same time? Is that what's happening with
I'd love to see the quote. I'm not familiar with it, but it's something that that I have learned over the years, conflicting values. The same person who can tell you that an abortion is manslaughter, five questions later will tell you I'm pro-choice.
Could it possibly be that they just haven't thought it through?
Well, there's always that element, sure. You know, and there are a lot of people who have other priorities in their life than to think these things through. But still, there are values that are revealed when people take positions on issues like this. And frankly, in an issue like abortion, one can be seriously conflicted and be honest about it.
John Zogby is our guest. His book is The Way We'll Be. I guess it'll tell you how old you are if that makes you think of the Barbra Streisand song, The Way We Were. If it evokes that, then you're too old to be a first global, right?
I've just pinpointed where you fit.
No, I don't think you have. We're going to get to that next. I'm Dean Olscher, by the way. I'm filling in for Leonard Lopate today on the show. You say that the generation older than the first globals are the Nikes and that they began in 1965. However, I'm sort of on the cusp, came in 1963. I identify so much more with the Nikes, who also have no idea who Barbra Streisand was or what the Way We Were was. So I feel that in terms of values, those of us who came in at the tail end of the baby boom generation react very strongly against it because it has dominated culture so much.
And you would. We're your older brothers and sisters, and it wasn't terribly pleasant living with us, I have to say. But yeah, you're right. In much the same way that Barack Obama is not Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, even though technically a baby boomer. So there's need for more refinement. But by and large, in terms of pigeonholing these into broader categories of yeah, well, you're a tweener.
So the rest of the world calls them Generation X. You call it the Nike generation. Winged victory, yes, but really it has to do with brands?
It does, to a great degree, and a lifestyle. This is the group that grew up for the first time with families that were breaking up with divorces, with Watergate, with a breakdown of familiar institutions that were supposed to provide honor and comfort and security. And so pretty much an orphan generation. The motto early in life was me. Mm. If it feels good, do it, hence the term Nike. However, what we find is that in terms of the second act for Nikes who are getting up there,
Thanks. thanks for pointing that out.
but in terms of Nikes, there's kind of a coming back to the security and comfort of these familiar institutions. They will be better parents.
How would you compare the two, the Nikes and the first globals? What are the stark contrasts between those two generations?
The notion of travel, the notion of facility with the internet, and more importantly, with and the key difference is that Nikes are very libertarian with a small L because they're not really wedded to any institution that would provide those kinds of restrictions.
So we're talking about slackers versus people with a really strong environmental consciousness.
Very much so. And the contrasts in the book are stunning. In fact, the differences between just these two generations, let alone, you know, when we get into boomers and so on. Let's go back to first globals for a minute. They're not perfect. You know, my wife and I were at the Miami airport getting off a plane several months ago, and as we were going through the jet bridge, a group of young people passed us and pushed and knocked my wife down, and she looked at me and she said, "You and your globals, I want you to write an afterword to your book since these pages were written," because I'm very high on the group. But clearly, though, with the globals, they're not necessarily the smartest, but there's a consciousness there that is light years ahead of even the Nikes. They're growing up really with a whole planet.
Mm. Our guest is John Zogby, the pollster. We're going to take a little break and then we'll be right back. I'm Dean Olscher, filling in for Leonard Lope. Today, John Zogby is our guest. His book is The Way Will Be, The Zogby Report on the Transformation of the American Dream. He creates two new categories for us to think about today, traditional materialists versus secular spiritualists. Please define.
Well, you know, when we think of the American Dream, we think of everything from settling the frontier to moving to the suburbs to a plot of land, my own home. And it's generally defined in material terms. For others, it's much more than that. You know, it's becoming wealthy, being an entrepreneur and a wealthy entrepreneur. But what we have found over the last decade and a little bit is that there's a slow and steady transition, and that there are technically now more who tell us that the American dream for them means more about spiritual fulfillment. And that when we plumb the depths a little bit, what we find is that they eschew the old traditional materialism and are saying there's got to be more to life than this.
How and why did this happen?
There's a combination of reasons, actually a multiplicity of reasons. For some, it's been enforced upon them. 27% of American adults work at a job that pays less than a previous job. We found when we first started looking at this group, the work for less group, that they were the angry white man in the early 1990s. And why were they angry? About this condition, but I'm going to get it back. Mm. I'm going to keep this house. I'm going to keep these cars. I'm going to keep the boat.
Right.
As this set in and became permanent, and then folks got into their second, third round of lower-paying jobs, for this group, it was an adjustment to reality. Look, it's not going to happen again. Hence, there are dollar stores and Walmarts, and there's got to be more to life than
so
this.
They are secular spiritualists, but not because they are naturally drawn to be that way. It is, again, situational in a response to circumstance.
But it's a long-term circumstance as opposed to a briefly imposed one. It's much the same as when I was a kid, growing up in an industrial town.
Utica, New York.
Utica, New York. Everybody's dad worked at a manufacturing plant and would be laid off.
Yeah.
But that meant, you know, when inventories decline, we'll be back. You know, in 1982 and then more so even in 1991, structural recessions, you're not laid off. You're let go. The plant is shut down. Yeah. It's not coming back. You've got to adjust. And so people are adjusting. But then there's the other end of the spectrum. Those who have attained and done quite well and who have clearly said to themselves, you know, is this all there is? Mm. I mean, there's got to be more to this. Add to that all people in between who've made this adjustment demographically. Those in their 50s and 60s who are saying, you know, I probably have 30 more years of my life in good health. Do I want to simply be defined in terms of chasing after something? Do I want to be defined by what my job is today? I have all this life ahead of me. I want to do something that is more meaningful to me and maybe more meaningful to my community and world. There are these conscious choices that are being made.
So you describe these changes, the secular spiritualists, the first globals, and you also describe a leadership that is not in touch with these changes that are happening.
It's a time warp. There's a huge disconnect, and this is where I get into the discussion of this election, that essentially it's a reverse cultural lag. The people are doing just fine making the adjustments. What they're looking for now are answers, and not necessarily ideological answers. That was 2004. Today, this election is about a problem solver, about competence, about capabilities of getting the job done.
You point to a couple of events that happened in the last 10 years, September 11th, Hurricane Katrina, that bring home the idea that we're on our own.
Yes.
Government is not going to protect us.
Basically, and that's a conclusion that Americans have made. In some ways, I suggest that Katrina will be more of a defining moment than 9/11 because of that. 9/11 at least created a bonding and a sense that Americans not only needed each other, but needed their familiar institutions for comfort and security. You remember the president's numbers went way up, but so did everybody else's. Congress, the Democrats, the Republicans, corporations, people went back to church. They were religious already, but they went back to church. And then you had a confluence of events, going to war, Enron and WorldCom, the corporate scandals, the Catholic Church scandal, and things started to slowly but surely come apart, a crisis in confidence, and then literally, pow, Katrina happens. A very, very powerful image of a government that not only did not respond, but for all intents and purposes didn't exist in people's lives, and a sense that just as you opened up with your question, government wasn't there.
How do you find these things out? You're known for asking unusual questions in your polls. How do you go about finding out these things? What questions would you ask? For example, you talk about one of them. I'll lead the witness. You contrast the Tin Man from the Scarecrow.
Well, never discount the power of taking a shower every morning.
Right.
It seems like that's when all these great ideas.
Best ideas.
Yeah, somebody's got to figure out a way that, you know, you can put a board in your shower and you can write these feverishly. But what I try to do.
Hey, we have to patent that.
Yes.
The shower idea note taker.
That's
right. Waterproof. Okay.
We're going into business when the show is over.
Don't tell anybody that.
Truth be told, you can ask people's opinions on anything, especially things that they don't care about or think about. But if you attach a value onto that question, then what you're doing is you're getting at people's heart. And so the Tin Man versus the Scarecrow, I could have asked that straight up, and maybe a lot of people wouldn't have known.
Well, what would have been the straight up? What were you actually trying to find out?
It was the contrast that everybody was making between Al Gore and George W. Bush. The Tin Man was all brains and no heart.
Stiff.
Yes. And the scarecrow was all heart and no brains.
The compassionate conservative as he presented himself in 2000.
And so when we put that in the Saturday, Sunday before the 2000 election, as I write in the book, it came out 46.2 for the Tin Man and 46.2 for the scarecrow. And that was stunning and a little scary.
And that's how you knew
That I wasn't going to know.
That no one was going to have the answer on election day of who won the election.
Right. And as I tell the story, I got a call from the Vice President Gore the night before the election. Mine was the only poll showing him going up and being ahead in the popular vote. And he said, am I going to win tomorrow? And I said, I don't know. I didn't get into the Tin Man and Scarecrow. there are some things that are much better left for later on. But, the reality was, I said to him, in fact, I don't know what's going to happen in Florida. It's been a one-point race, and it's not moving.
What was it about framing the question in that way that made it weird and different?
Because I wanted to take people away from the election, put them in a different context, but get at something that was emblematic of what was going on. And this way, there were enough people who were out there that didn't quite necessarily relate to the Tin Man as Al Gore and the Scarecrow as George W. Bush. And so I just wanted to see if that would tell me something. And boy, in that case, it did. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, interestingly, as I point out in the book, I tried it again in 2004. But in 2004, the Tin Man and the Scarecrow.
Right.
But what happened in 2004 was that there were enough people who regarded George W. Bush as either tough-minded, intelligent and decisive in when it came to decision-making, that in short, it didn't work. So it doesn't always work.
Hmm. This is the Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Dean Olscher. Our guest today is John Zogby, and you're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. There are a couple of other concepts that you float that are important now to America in a way that they have not been in the past. One is authenticity,
mm-hmm.
and another is transparency. Transparency, well, they go together. Transparency having to do with the internet, and you write something that feels so contradictory, well, contrary to my own experience. You basically say, and this is true, the internet is a great thing. It broadens us. It exposes us to other views. It is making the world a better place. But at the same time, while that's true, I find that it is really bringing out the worst in everybody.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That's another fascinating contradiction that happens.
It is, and it's part of the shakedown. Remember, with these new technologies come good and bad. Oftentimes, bad outweighs the good. I don't think necessarily with the internet, I'm not a believer, I'm not a 100% market classical capitalist, but I do believe the shakedown will occur, and that some of these blogs, which quite frankly I liken to daily conferences of fetal alcohol babies, I have some real problems with these things, but I think that will subside, and that you'll just get a kind of a cream of the crop that will rise. Now, there'll be ugly blogs, and everyone from Nazi groups on one hand to other kinds of crazies on the other hand will continue to be with us and to some degree be empowered, but other groups will be empowered as well.
Well, getting back to the question of authenticity and transparency, you have the gossip, page 6 writ large every day on various websites on the internet. And so people have a very different idea now of what privacy is or if they even have an opportunity to have it.
Yeah, and there's a downside to our first globals who are redefining what privacy is all about as they, and I tell some anecdotes in addition to data about they're wanting their 15 minutes of fame. They're wanting to, for reasons that a guy my age will never understand, will post the most intimate aspects of their lives and pictures on the internet because they want to. Because they think it's something to do to literally and figuratively expose themselves to their friends and build friendships in an intimate way over the internet. And in some ways, it's supposed to be authenticity. in other ways, it's been abused and could be very dangerous.
So let's separate these things. Yes, authenticity, but not as we necessarily understand the word, right?
Not always, no. But in some ways, yes, authenticity in a very positive way, in the sense that we've seen this year, interestingly, just jumping into politics, that negative campaigning has not been as effective as it's been in the past. And I'm going to suggest to you that it's not going to be going into the general election. People have a clearer picture of what they want. They don't know who they want, but they do know what they want in terms of a problem solver. And interestingly, say what you anybody can say about either of these two candidates, but in many ways they did present themselves as potentially the most authentic of Republicans and the most authentic of Democrats with real stories to tell. By the same token, as consumers, what we're finding, and we do a little thing in here with some questions in a poll, people prefer the $250 item that they can get in a Walmart bag to the $500 similar item that has a Tiffany's box. Now, that doesn't mean that people still don't want a little taste and class in their lives, but it is suggesting that we're moving towards authenticity. Give me something real. As I put in there in my lesson to marketers, consumers are saying, you know, give us the steak and less of the sizzle.
It's funny that Walmart is perceived as being more authentic than Tiffany's, because in my mind, the association is Tiffany is the best made real thing and Walmart is giving you the knockoff.
Exactly. And yet that's sort of being defined as people are saying to themselves, I want what works. You know, I want quality, but I want what works. And for many, Walmart defines quality as well because of functionality.
Mm-hmm. How did you become a pollster, and why did you want to become one?
I'm a historian by training, and so there's a soft spot for asking good questions and loving it when data comes in and riffing, trying to figure out what it all means and putting it together. And I'm also a recovered politician. Mm-hmm. I was an activist. So I'm both a recovering academic and a recovering politician. I ran for mayor of Utica at a time when nobody did local polls, and we did polls with our students. And I knew exactly how much I was going to lose by. And I said,
and why?
And why? And I said, hey, you know what? We're pretty good at this, you know? I did a couple of things for a few years, but by 1984, enough of a comfort level with my skills to strike out on my own and form a consulting firm that did a bunch of things, including retail advertising and public relations. But polling was the one thing that was unique, especially on the level we were doing it, local communities, counties, sheriff's races, and an area where the blue highways approach, I would call it. You know, we let the Mark Penns and Doug Schoens of the world have the interstates.
So consumer polling makes up the largest part of your work.
It does, yeah.
And as we said before, it informs your political work. I want to know, just on its own, what is it that's exciting to you about knowing what people want to shop for and why?
Because it reveals a big part of who we are and how we make our decisions, which, because it's such a vital part of who we are, we shop in some way every day, that it tells us a picture of not only individuals, I think much more importantly, a categorization of groups of individuals. We're always looking for how do we cluster people into groups, because that determines how they drive decisions, how decisions are driven. Also tells us something about how they'll vote.
I have to say, though, there is this, I'm sure you've heard this a million times, there's a side to me that hears that and has the knee-jerk response, oh, come on, this is just voodoo. You're making this up. There's not any real science to it.
Polling? Oh, no, there's a lot of science to it. You know, it's random probability sampling. It's some people are very good making seat-of-the-pants decisions, but others rely very, very heavily on the science of this, of doing good sampling, but the art as well, asking good questions. And, you know, I think it's more dramatic when you get an election right, because, you know, the whole world is watching, and with remarkable accuracy, even if you're 1 or 2 points off, you know, you're making a call on the basis of 1,000 people or 1,200 people. But less dramatic, but of great importance, is being able to apply those same rules to a company's strategic plan or trotting out a new product.
What do you think is the next big idea that you need to pursue as a pollster? What's been overlooked so far?
Oh, I think the world's global generation. This vast number of people, staggeringly so in terms of numbers, it may be small percentages in some countries, but a global generation that is just going to be so mobile, so facile with technology, and a new generation of leadership. That's the next step for me. I want to find out what's going on in Dubai, what's going on in France, what's going on in Russia.
I can't tell you how many people I know are teaching their kids Chinese so that they're ready for what's going to happen next.
And they should.
Yeah. John Zogby is the author of The Way Will Be, and he's been our guest here this morning on the Leonard Lopate Show. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.